Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Jonathan Last, sitting in for your regular host, the great Charlie Sykes. I am joined today by an old friend of mine. Not meaning that he's old, but just that we've been together for forever.
Literally old.
Mike.
Literally old.
The great Mike Murphy, who is one of the... one of the smartest guys, but whatever. The smart guys are a dime a dozen in Washington. One of the best guys I've ever met in my DC time. And Mike, it is great to have you on the show again.
Well, you're in thank LA you, now. My
you
friend.
Made it out. You escaped from DC. You did it.
I fled to run the Schwarzenegger campaign in 2003, and I looked around and I said, the weather's nice 340 days a year. There's socialism, but that seems to be on the march everywhere. So net, it's a winner. Met a girl, married her, had a daughter, and I now live in Los Angeles, California, except when we subway to New Hampshire in the summer.
That is awesome. So let's get right to what's going on here in DC this week, which is maybe Charlie said in his newsletter this morning, green shoots for centrism. So here's what we've had this week. We have the outline of an infrastructure bill compromise. We have Joe Manchin putting forth a skinny voting rights bill, which is good enough to have gotten Stacey Abrams on board within like 4 minutes. We have a bipartisan passing in regular order of the creation of Juneteenth as a federal holiday. And we have two Supreme Court opinions, which don't really make anybody very upset.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
So what does that now? So Charlie and Crystal are Sykes and Crystal are like, yes, this is our bipartisan, no labels future. And I look at this and I just think you guys are Lucy with a football. Who's right?
Well, you to much affection from me. I don't know if you're Irish, but you have the Irish outlook of, yes, there's a green shoot, but there's also a huge giant lawnmower coming because that is life and we're screwed and we live in a tawdry one-ringed circus of politics where it's very hard for anything good to happen in the modern era. Long term, I'm a little more optimistic. So what do I think? I'm not quite in the little crystal sunshine area. On Hacks on Tap, they always call me Little Murphy Sunshine. So I'm going to pass that moniker on to Bill. But no, I think the infrastructure thing has a better chance to happen than not. Does that mean it's all change? No, I think it might kind of be like the famous Christmas story in World War II, where the two sides stop killing each other and go out and kind of talk like humans for 2 hours and then go back to the slaughter the next day. The reason I think it may happen on the infrastructure side is there are enough senators who are sane, I believe, to get to that magic 60 point and then stop probably in both parties and understand that, one, with super low interest rates, borrowing $1 trillion for capital spending, you know, bridge, port, electricity, water, helps make our economy more competitive. It's a moneymaker, helps us compete in the world economy. So policy-wise, it's a really good move. Now, I don't know if they can spend it appropriately. I know there are going to be all kinds of steam towns at the end, but fundamentally, net-net, it is a good move forward. And I think they also understand that getting something real, 9-to-5, lunch pail, infrastructure bill, serious business done for the country in a non-tribal massacre way would be a really, really good thing, a real restart. The problem we have is, of course, with humans, as always, and I'll be quick here because I can ramble on forever about this kind of stuff. The problem is the human greed. You know, the Democrats cannot take the mission of, hey, why don't we rebuild normalcy? No. They've got to go do the New Deal or go spend 1.5 times the cost of World War II in adjusted dollars. You know, and that greed is, political greed is a problem. The infrastructure bill is a huge win for the country, not ideologically, just functionally, and to show the world we can function again. And I think they ought to grab that thing and do it. $1.2 trillion is a great number. It's historical. And just put the political ideological greed aside and score one for the system. And I think in the end they will.
So I'm short on this bill. And in terms of,
you're short on everything, though.
I'm short on America.
You ever seen the movie The Cooler with Bill Macy? I'm sure you have.
Exactly. I am Bill Macy.
You walk by the crap table and everybody gets wiped out.
Yeah.
But you might be right. You've been right so far, I will say.
So what are the incentives for Republicans to go along with this? You know, everything's fine now. You've got your, you know, however many Republicans who are, you know, signed on in theory, but we are one Trump press release away from, can you believe these rhinos helping socialist sleepy Joe Biden with the worst deal in the history of hugeness?
Right.
And then these guys are going to run for the hills.
Well, that'll be the test. I think the pressure on them, some will have civic purpose. That'll be a single digit number. Okay. Maybe we'll get to high single digits there. Remember, in the world that politicians exist in, even Republican politicians, in the external world, yeah, you worry about your crazy primary voters wearing Uncle Sam suits and waiting for the MAGA bulletins from Crazy Town. But you also have the kind of micro-politician world where they spend their time all day with the big economic and labor interest of their state, other politicians, and every county commissioner and mayor and suburban Republican state rep and you know, the whole armada of the system they swim around in and bump into every day are screaming at them for the infrastructure money. That's why historically the feds have liked to do this kind of thing. You know, their big employers are. I mean, here in California, you know, we've got all kinds of problems with our ports, which means our huge critical ports are going to start, that share is going to be taken away as the Chinese fund new ports in Mexico. So in the inside game, the pressure to open the checkbook and do something is tremendous. So they're going to be torn. And I think the 11 who've signed on to the bipartisan thing, at least initially, they know there's MAGA trouble coming. They're not fools about that. And I think on this one, if they kill off all the, and I'll use pejorative Republican campaign hack terms here, if they kill off all the welfare-y stuff that Biden wanted to jam up the bill with in the beginning and make it mostly pouring concrete, I think it's pretty defensible. And I don't think all of them will fold. We only need 10 here. And I think there's a fighting chance. But you're right. The Trump bleat will have an impact, and we'll see. This will be a wonderful lab test of, are there 10 who will put the country ahead of MAGA?
So because this is, you know, political incentives have changed. Part of it is what you see. You know, we have two senators who are misaligned from the presidential preferences of their state. Right. I think there's only two left nationally, Manchin and Collins.
Right.
And I saw a poll last week asking, I think it was Missouri primary voters. And they said, you know, what do you want out of your next senator? Do you want somebody who is going to look out for Missouri and bring home the bacon and blah, 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 blah? Or do you want somebody who's going to go to Washington and fight Joe Biden to stop his agenda? And it was 60-30, fight Joe Biden.
Yeah, no. But keep in mind, I've got to say, all true, but primary voters are a little more fungible than people think. You know, they take a second out of the day to opine, and they generally do the tribal noise. Now, by the way, I'm surprised that it wasn't 80% murder Joe Biden, burn him at the cross. And so you always look at the number minus 50. So they're 10 points above breaking even on it. There's some interesting Fabrizio data, the Republican pollster Tony Fabrizio, who worked for Trump. We had him on Hacks on Tap a month ago or so, maybe a little longer. And he had done a big primary poll of those voters. And really, you look at the Trump thing, it's not the monolith people think. You've got a plurality that's all Trump all the time. But then you've got a majority that's either hate Trump, smaller group. Yeah, you know, he's okay, but I'm not so sure. Or, yeah, he's wonderful, but let's move on. And so I think the, you know, politics, as you know, runs on anecdotal information. These guys in the cloakroom telling each other, God, at my town hall, the red hats ate me alive because I, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, oh, they all get worked up. But then there's a defining event. We all remember this. Well, we probably don't all remember, but being, as your kind introduction indicated, Jurassic, I remember the Harris Wofford special in Pennsylvania in the early 90s where it was an upset. And he talked about health care. That means the whole national political agenda has got to be health care. And then it was health care. So these anecdotal things can start a big ball rolling. If the Trump world does not massacre next summer and spring, a bunch of these, Liz Cheney's, Anthony Gonzalez, Katko up in New York, John Katko, Fred Upton in Michigan, et cetera, et cetera. Kinzinger, if he still has a district. If they survive their primaries, and I think a bunch of them will be able to, then the anecdotal thing, wow, Trump's ray gun isn't as big as we thought. You know, we just haven't had that mark-to-market moment yet, and we won't for a while. So I think some of these folks are overstating the actual on-the-ground impact of the MAGA stuff. But to your point, it still doesn't mean they won't be cowed by it and act that way until something realigns their thinking. So yeah. This will be the test. I agree with you about that.
Well, I actually want to spend some time talking about Gonzales in Ohio in a minute. But before we do that, so let's move from the infrastructure to the Manchin voting rights bill. Manchin comes out with what seems to be an awfully sensible voting rights bill, something that addresses basically, you know, you break apart the individual components of it, and I suspect every single thing in it polls over 65%. People want voter ID of some sort, and Manchin does voter ID in a way that is straight shooting and not designed to, you know, actually suppress minorities and old people. They like, really, really like having Election Day be a federal holiday. They like being able to do early voting. They like all the things. And Stacey Abrams jumps out very early and I think very, very helpfully to keep the progressives on side on this. And Mitch McConnell rushes out at emergency press conferences and basically just vomits out a bunch of words that sound like conservative bingo. You know, he says this is more cancel culture, First Amendment. And then he says, you know, then he blames computers. You know, he says, we don't want to let the computer. I mean, things.
Yeah, which yeah, I agree.
It was word salad. And so what's going to happen here with voting rights? Manchin has.
Well, it's dead. I applaud Manchin. Two, I thought the Abrams thing was an interesting tell. She is a smart Paul.
She and sure is, isn't she?
Yeah. So keep an eye on her. I often say, and I'm often ridiculed, but I would not be surprised if she primaries Harris, who keeps stumbling and doesn't have some of the campaign chops that I think conventional wisdom assumes she has. But if you look back, it's been stumble, stumble, single, home run, single, stumble, stumble. It's uneven with Vice President Harris. But anyway, to the bill. You know, I double agree with Manchin. On one hand, I like his move here, and he made a horrible bill much better and essentially palatable. And two, he has a secondary critique, he says, which is I'm generally not in favor of changing election procedure rules on a completely partisan basis, because that only increases the division. And he's been scoffed at by the progressives for that, but he's right. He's right. I mean, the Republicans have set this awful precedent of going down and screwing around with election bills in Georgia and a really bad one bubbling in Texas. Now, caveat, it's not quite the Jim Crow stuff the Democrats have politically reacted to, sensing a huge win. But morally, it is a step backwards. And I think the Georgia thing was done in bad faith. So I did, and I will continue to condemn it. And there are other bills around the country that are worse, or some that aren't that terrible. But fundamentally, Republicans have started screwing around on a partisan basis in the states. And I don't really think the answer is, okay, let's federalize the crime from the other side, which is why a Manchin-type bill is so important. Because we could, on a bipartisan basis, if anybody had any civic purpose, pass something like that and help reinforce the overall democracy franchise, which I think to you and to me and our compatriots is really like important. And, you know, McConnell checked out of that. And right now the Republicans are treating it like a totally partisan power grab, which the Manchin version is not. And they're going to vote it down. I don't think there are a noble 11. I think a few will. But it is a yet another low point for our beloved Republican Party.
So what does this do to Manchin himself with his filibuster stance?
Well, he could, you know, we could get to the old vaudeville thing of Niagara Falls. Slowly I turn, step by step. And maybe Manchin starts looking at something that was bandied about before, which is kind of the conditional filibuster override special case deal. And I think Manchin, he hasn't said it, but by proposing a reasonable compromise and then having Mitch you know, do his Genghis Khan act on it. I would think the smart mansion watchers in the GOP would think, we're cornering them, boys. Think about that. You know, we ought to be nice to our savior here. And so that could be the next chapter. We're going to have some test votes, I guess, coming. And I wouldn't be surprised in the next 48 hours if Manchin doesn't say, wow, we might have to put the filibuster aside briefly to do something like this, which will be quite a shot across the bow. You know, it's weird. I don't normally see McConnell make dumb moves. And I thought his antagonistic reaction to Manchin's bill was a dumb move.
Well, I don't
because I think it isolates Manchin is my point, and that is not in the Republican interest on everything else.
Well, except that the Republican interest here is to just assume that Manchin is going to hold firm, and if Manchin is going to hold firm, then you've got to object to everything. Right.
Yeah. My view, though, is if I've learned in 30 years of politics, never bet on a politician to relentlessly hold firm in all situations.
Yeah.
That's a Marx bet.
That's fair. I mean, when I look at this, if you were a Democratic strategist, what is the argument against going full Vox? Right. You know, reform the filibuster, add D.C. as a state, maybe even reform the SCOTUS after having Mitch McConnell say that entirely possible that he would not hold a vote on a 2023 Supreme Court nominee, which is the most insane thing ever. There are moral and civic reasons not to play pure constitutional hardball. But if you're the Democrats, what is the political downside of any of this? Because
there's not. I mean, you know, you always appeal to the mob, and the Democratic mob doesn't want a filibuster. But I think my inside ball strategy would be, look, we got to pry Manchin loose from the Republicans, and if he decides not to run again, which may be where he's leaning, let him walk the plank with us. So how do we
and get break DC off as Manchin? A state. Add, right. So this is what I'm saying. You got to break him off so that you can then add DC.
But you got to be careful about adding the state. You know, there was a period in American history where we did a lot of that. North and South Dakota were not a natural thing. And so if they start minting senators that way, then California can become two states and we can carve out Fresno and the Valley and create two more senators there. It becomes an arms race, and it's happened before. So I think the D.C. thing, short term, I get it. Long term, I think we're gonna have 19 states made out of Utah. So I'm not sure that's so smart. But if they can tactically isolate Manchin, then they get him for what they really need ideologically, which is all this New Deal 2.0 stuff they want to try to do on reconciliation next. Where they still don't have him on all that budget stuff. So I would try to drive a wedge. I would take Manchin's bill, endorse it, pass it, fail, raise holy hell, embitter Manchin, and then, wheel around and start spending money and see if you can move them there and maybe even get them on some more aggressive filibuster thing. I think McConnell is putting Manchin more in play than he ought to for a dumb reason that has no moral standing at all. In fact, has moral standing against it. So he's making kind of the cynical evil ploy and the one that I think is shameful for no political gain, I think. I think he's put himself in a more vulnerable position.
Well, but this is what the Republican Party has become. This is a party which no longer looks at politics as a how do I get to 50 plus one. They have abandoned that, and they've abandoned it without even pretending to not have abandoned it. They now look at the world of, how can we get power with 44% or 46%? Yeah.
No, that's become a catalog business. They have a small group of ardent shoppers, and they only care about them, and now they're totally in the, I call it the junkyard dog theory of politics, bark at everything.
It is fully, their only real imperative is to preserve institutional leverage, which allows them to hold minority power.
But I would add a caveat to that. I think that strategy is illuminated by two anecdotally driven beliefs that are real as gravity to them, and they may be disproven going forward. One belief is Trump has a big faucet down there in the zebra-coated bathroom that he can turn on or off the Trump vote for Republicans. So if Trump says stay home, they're all going to stay home. That theory has never worked in politics. People forget that these Trump voters, many, not all, but many of them used to be called Republican primary voters, and they threw the lever for a lot of candidates, including Mitt Romney, who is now the great villain. So I'm not sure Trump, they think, though, that Trump can say, stay home, and they lose every election. So Trump has a doomsday weapon that they're terrified of. And they're afraid of primaries, that Trump can go nuke them. If they didn't believe those two things, they would be acting differently. So that's why the midterm election primaries are so important, because I think some of those beliefs might be shaken. And Trump will evolve. The only rule in politics is everything's always evolving. You don't know the direction. You don't know the rate. But we'll see if the Trump gold standard of today is the Trump gold standard of next March. And so, the primaries are going to be the measuring stick that the politicians in the Republican universe are going to watch. And what they do will create the new reality one way or the other.
So let's talk about that. The primary season begins in earnest in just a week or two, on June 26th, when former President Donald J. Trump journeys to Wellington, Ohio, to the grand old Lorain County Fairgrounds, where he will hold a Save America rally in support of Max Miller, who is launching a primary challenge against Anthony Gonzalez, who voted for impeachment too. And the whole thing is weird because, as you say, Ohio's losing a district. You know, maybe this seat, the Ohio 16 seat, doesn't exist. Maybe Kinzinger's seat doesn't exist. Ohio also has a new redistricting reform, which is not entirely nonpartisan, but is kind of nonpartisan, and which is going to make it a lot harder for the R's in Ohio to, I think it's 12-4 is how they have the balance now. I think it's going to be harder for them to do that. So what should we look for? I mean, what do we think this is even going to look like? You know, is it going to be 4,000 people who show up or 25,000? Is it, is he going to be together in what's the Latin phrase, you know, compass mentis, you know, like,
or no, I think it'll be one, it'll be what it always is. Trump can put on a nice show and get a nice show crowd. You know, in a primary where you may have 60,000 voters, 4,000 people in a metal shed is interesting, but it's more interesting to the press that wants to put on jodhpurs and, you know, Stanley and Livingston outfits and go explore the scary world of the red states and the Republican Party. I think it'll be subpar in terms of turnout and everything compared to a presidential rally, simply because he isn't president, but it'll be an impact. The problem for old Max, the Trumpy guy running against Gonzalez, is one, Gonzalez is tough. Guy played in the NFL. He was a star at Ohio State, and he's fast on his feet. He's going to be well-funded, so he ain't no pushover. And second, he's got good district connections. Our friend Frank Lavin is helping Gonzalez. You know, Frank worked in the Reagan political office. I mean, he's hardly a left-wing radical. Gonzalez is a good Republican conservative and an up-and-coming star. Second, when you're the primary opponent, you got Trump helping you. You also have the overhead of Trump helping you. So in the future, if he does a lot of visits there, it's a big expensive thing that a struggling primary campaign to fund Trump's vanity will be draining Miller's coffers, because there's limits to how much of it a Trump PAC or whatever can pay once Miller's a announced candidate. So I like it right now. It's invincible. Trump plans to steamroll, you know, Mary Cheney, Miller, Upton. You can go down the list of the Jamie Herrera Butler, all the Trump villains, and in Trump's mind, and he'll we'll find out. Now, short term though, I think he'll just throw a fit. It'll be, I hate McConnell, I hate the infrastructure deal, I hate Gonzalez. You know, he'll just do Trump grievance. Because apparently, not surprisingly, the reports are he's running around Mar-a-Lago with kind of, I kept joking a year ago, he'd build a fake Oval Office and just announce he's still president down there and have a couple of yes men, you know, find some guy thrown out of the Air Force as a major to give him secret security briefings and just live a fantasy world of a madman. And I think the speech will reflect that mentality.
Well, so what, I mean, this, what the speech could do, especially when, it, you know, whenever you have him just vamping, we could get official Trump policy, right? I mean, he could set the Trump line against the infrastructure bill.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Way, yeah. Probably would try.
And so if he does that, all of a sudden, then you're going to have a bunch of Republicans scared of, well, you know, how do I get to the other side? So when you look at, you know, I look again. So this district is going to change. This is Ohio 16. Trump ran 12 points behind Gonzalez in 2020. It's 93% white. I mean, I don't even quite know what to make of a district like this. When you say, you know, can a guy who is running 12 points ahead of Trump be beaten in a Trump focused primary that is about nothing other than Donald Trump trying to knock him off? Like, what?
Well, the question is on the ground there, will it be about Trump trying to knock it off? Or will Gonzalez say, look, you know, President, I disagree on the former president, but let's move on. Here's what I want to do. I want to stop the big spending. I want to get jobs here. I would like to make the steel for 20,000 miles of railroad track here in our factories, et cetera, et cetera. And Gonzalez ought to go on offense about a bunch of that stuff and kind of treat Trump like the rearview mirror, which is where, again, a majority of the Republican primary voters in that Fabrizio data think Trump ought to be. So if Gonzalez is clever about this, he can make Trump the crazy old uncle ranting and raving and move the race. Now, the national media coverage will all be Trump all the time. They're in the Trump business, to their discredit, though I will say they've been good at not over-covering him since he's been president. I've been pleasantly surprised by that. But, you know, Gonzalez has his half of the orchestra here, and he doesn't have to be, yeah, I hate Donald Trump, let's vote about that. That's not as good of a race of, I fit here, I'm a conservative, let's move on.
Well, this is the question, right? Is everything nationalized or not? And can
right.
you
generally
can
locally
you still
it's
run?
Not, but the press is always nationalized because that they think their role is to inform the conversation of Beltway dinner parties.
So when you look at then the 2022 results, what would good results be for Democrats? What would good results be for Trump? And what would good results be? What results do you think are going to influence the chances of him running again in 2024?
Well, I think the best thing, obviously, for Democrats would be to hold the House, which will be tough. And as far as because that would more further discredit Trump as a you know anchor around the neck of any hope of conservative Republican governance. But in the primaries, the best thing, frankly, is to show that a majority of the people on Trump's death list survived their primaries, maybe a strong majority. I mean, if most of the 10 can get reelected, which I think is totally possible, then all of a sudden the Trump ray gun, you know, can warm up a hot dog, but it can't kill you. That will be a huge, huge change in temperament among about half the Republican House conference. The other half are long gone. And the senators will feel that. So I think the story can't be Trump avenges. The story has to be Trump has no teeth. And that is the best thing for both the party and the worst thing for Trump.
What is Kevin McCarthy?
And by the way, you know who's hoping for that more than anybody who's not on the ballot is McConnell.
Yeah, McConnell-McCarthy. So what are these guys going to do about this, right? I mean, the official position of parties is always that we support our incumbents. And am I incorrect in thinking that this is just simply something that has never happened to have a former president running around the country trying to primary members of his own party?
I mean, you know, I'm trying to think. There might have been one case or, you know, there was a few kind of earlier versions of the Steve Kings of the world who are outliers, but nothing like this. No, where Jerry Ford leaves the presidency and goes on a jihad in his own party.
Right.
And, you know, it is the committee is always support incumbents. The question is how much. But the truth is what they say publicly is not important. It's whether or not what they do directing PAC money and major donors. My guess is there will be a rump group in the House who will make a lot of stink about the NRCC supporting the Gonzaleses of the world. And that'll be internal Republican politics. The dissident factor will go public because they want the Fox machine to applaud it. So that'll become a tempest in a teapot in the Kremlinology of GOP stuff. But on the ground, I think it'll be the incumbents will raise money. I think the committee will quietly help with that. And, you know, McConnell's got his own operation, which in some of these Senate primaries may stand up against Trump. And so we'll see. Trump's got the persona, but the machinery and the money, if the candidates are good and can be amplified by people who don't want Trump to dominate the primaries, including McConnell, will be there quietly working with a lot of muscularity, I think.
What, I mean, can these guys, especially the Trump-backed ones, can they just overcome all of the money problems with small dollar? Right. I mean, look at the amount of money that Josh Hawley raised when he, you know, got into trouble for 5 minutes. And, you know, I just wonder if small dollar money is, you know, apes strung together, right?
Yeah. Well, look, the internet's democratized fundraising. So used to be direct mail. The anti-establishment candidates often, if they were well known enough, would raise significant gross money. There just wasn't a lot of net money because the cost of direct mail fundraising for low dollar is so high. This time with the internet, it's not quite as much, but there are no shortage of thieves to get in the middle to profit. I mean, here in California, we have this comedy candidacy of Caitlyn Jenner, which is mostly a national direct mail campaign to enrich a bunch of Trump grifters who've latched onto her like barnacles. It was never a real campaign because being positioned as a Trump person kills you in California. But they're not destroying Newsom. They're just, you know, cashing in on her. So these campaigns that could have some low dollar fundraising ability often can get grifted out of a bunch of the money. But your fundamental point is right. They're going to have some money. I mean, you know, they will have enough to be known. They'll get plenty of earned media. So it won't purely be an auction. But everybody who's already an incumbent fighting off one of these people will have resources. And I think enough. I mean, you know, Mary Cheney will be loaded. She's in a fun situation. People, you know, who aren't political nerds like us, to understand it's not a, the Trump people, you know, the brain trust allegedly fired up all 82 IQ points and went out and tried to tell the Wyoming legislature to make Cheney's race a majority required race. And it's not, it's a plurality, and they failed. So, you know, when she was first elected in Wyoming, I think she won with like 40% or 39% of the vote. And we could be back to that world, because one great thing about the Trump land is there's always an internal squabble about who's the Trumpiest of all. So my guess is she'll have at least two people. There would be a main Trumper endorsed, and then there'd be a rogue rump Trumper saying, oh, I'm the real Trumper here. And, you know, that may allow her to prevail with 40% or 42% of the vote, 43, instead of needing to get to 50.
That's very interesting. So what do you think? I mean, the big question, I think, in American politics is, does he run again or not? Right. And nobody in the Republican Party can really move on until they get an answer to that question. Move on, I mean, just move ahead to whatever the next phase
is. Yeah, well, with certainty, they can't move ahead because Trump will play bluff poker. I may run any minute. I'm thinking about it. I just got called, can't tell you who, but 11 world leaders called begging me to run.
He has to do that all the way out, because otherwise he's not relevant. And this is like his means of production.
And I've always thought, and I've said for the last couple of years, that he will definitely do that. My gut was he won't run again, but he'll tease it to have influence and relevance endlessly. And, you know, then he'll tease his endorsement. Maybe I'll support the Democrat because he's desperate to be relevant. Now, so I don't know how to handicap it. I was intrigued just in terms of the literature of the apocalypse, in this idea that Trump would go pick up a Republican congressional district somewhere and go try to be speaker if we win the majority, you know, take over the conference, which, if life imitates art, that of course is the route, because that's the craziest thing. And it would be true to kind of try. And he could do that. He could go pick up a congressional seat and then try to run for leadership in the caucus. And my guess is they'd edge him out, but it would be an Aaron Allen Drury novel. But he's talked about that. Some radio kook thought of it, and of course Trump latched onto it. But putting that madness aside, I think he's most afraid of losing and downside protection, so he'll make a lot of noise. But ultimately, My guess is he won't run, particularly if a year from now he is in more legal trouble. And again, his super Trump potency is disproven in the midterms when he can't even go knock off of Fred Upton in Michigan.
See, I was for a long time kind of where you are. Well, you know, he'll tease it, but then he won't run. But I think that what happened post November 3 or November 6, whatever election day was, where he managed to convince 60 to 70% of the Republican Party that actually he won, that has eliminated his downside. You know, like he is so hedged in another race that he can run and, you know, he'll just say he won afterwards. And all the people who matter will say, not along. Yes, absolutely, Mr. President. Can't believe they did this to us again.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Could be. He's created a new world where there is no losing for him.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's just a universal rule of show business, which Trump understands with his kind of animal cunning, that sequels are rarely as good. It's spent. What's new about it? So while it would be indulgent for him, he could go run a campaign all about his grievances. There's not the same energy or wonder there. They're not the political scientists explaining that, oh, breathlessly, this is the new reality. American politics is fascinating. Trump-like thing. My analog for Trump has always been Jesse Ventura, which is, you know, phase one can't win. Phase two, amazing upset. Phase three, politics has been reinvented. You know, phase four, incompetent governor, personal feuds becomes boring. Phase five, fade to loss, defeat, and despair. So the Trump story has kind of been told in the arc of it all. And I'm not sure what Trump 2.0 would be other than a lamer version with more grievance and an older, less interesting Trump. And I think he feels that, but we'll see. The midterms, again, will set his temperature.
Yeah, and not just the voting in the midterms, but honestly, the crowd sizes.
All that,
The way he views the world. If he's getting 10 and 20,000 people turning out to see him, then the actual election returns won't matter. And if he's struggling to draw a crowd, then I think, you know, that might scare him.
Yeah, he needs to feel like a flop and a dud. And one thing that will work, I think, and I'm sure is a massive frustration to him, there are some tells, is he doesn't have Twitter and Facebook anymore. And when he started his blog, you know, literally smallenginerepair.com was getting much bigger traffic. So he is, you know, he's looking a little bit faded, has been-y, and the more that increases, the less I think he'll want to take the risk.
Yeah. All right. So listen, this is great. I've enjoyed our conversation, but I want to talk a little bit about Hollywood since I have
you
and you're out in Hollywood. And when we were talking,
I'm a dues-paying member of two unions out here. Can you believe it?
You're both a union guy now. Oh, I love it.
Writers Guild of America West and, of course, SAG-AFTRA.
So we were talking in the pre-show, and you mentioned an actor who is one of my favorites. And when you said his name, I realized I've been saying his name wrong for like.
Well, I'm not sure
years.
I am either. In fact, he teased me about that. But
so, David Strathairn or Strathairn or Strathairn?
I've been saying Strathairn, but let's call him David the Great Actor and a wonderful human being too.
So you, I wrote a giant John Sayles appreciation piece for the old magazine Once Upon a Time, and I watched, you know, from Return of the Sea Caucus 7 through Alligator and Eight Men Out and all the stuff, and that's where I first encountered David Strathairn and his work. And then, you know, he branched out from Sayles and became this indie darling, and then he, you know, he's just a great mainstream character. He's been in the Bourne movies, he's been in L.A. Confidential, and
he's in Nomadland.
What a great working actor. He's in Nomadland. Yeah, so, yeah. So tell me all about this guy.
He's a Zelig quality movie. Great? Yeah. Well, so I wrote and created a pilot for CBS about Capitol Hill called Ways and Means, starring Patrick Dempsey. And we went out into COVID and shot it and everything. And ultimately, it didn't go forward. The world of testing, the, you know, political shows
and network audiences don't really mix, but it was kind of about the family of the U.S. House. We had a lot of fun doing it. We had a tremendous cast. We had Holt McCauley, Amanda Warren, Troyanne Belisario, Arliss Howard, who's another tremendous actor who's always good, and you've seen him in a lot of, you saw Mank, he was Leo Mayer, the studio boss. And David, of course, who we lured to do television because he had liked the original script. And he's wonderful. I'll give you one on-set joke. I was asking him about, he was in the, there's this great sci-fi epic, The Expanse, where he shows up. And I said, that was kind of an interesting project. And he kind of looked at me with a twinkle in his eye. I said, yeah, I always wanted to play Long John Silver because he does it with this huge pirate accent and everything. But if you're a fan, I will steer you to something that is very near and dear to his heart. And any Hoyas out there will resonate to this. That being, of course, the bizarro term for We of Georgetown. There was a legendary professor at Georgetown named Jan Karski, who literally had been a kind of aristocratic family in Poland, who snuck into Auschwitz during the war, or one of the concentration camps, snuck out and got out of Poland and told the Allies about it in the middle of the war. Then he went back, got captured by the Gestapo, tortured, wound up a legendary professor of government and kind of living history at Georgetown. There's a stage play based on his life. If you Google Jan Karski Georgetown stage play, and David plays Karski, and he is incredible at it. There's kind of a film version, and I think they're trying, now that COVID's lifting, to put it on the road in Europe. It's kind of a one-man show. It is a project very close to his heart, and it is an amazing performance. So he was wonderful.
Is David a Georgetown guy?
No. He had just heard the story of Jan Karski, who I had as a professor, and all of us of my year at Georgetown remember him because he was a piece of heroic living history. I think there's a biography out on him now, Karski, and David was transfixed by the story and kind of brought him to life. And if you'd had him in a class, watching David play him was kind of like an amazing experience because he totally inhabited him. And he was great. He played a character we called the Liberal Lion, who was kind of the conscience of the Democratic Party and a mentor to Amanda Warren's character, who was up and coming. A big fun cast. Did it with a guy named Ed Redlich, who is a dear friend of mine, was an experienced CBS showrunner, and we had quite a journey together. So while I'm sad they didn't order it to series, it was fun, and he was one of a bunch of really, really great actors. Arliss, again, is a hoot. Damian Young, who is a wonderful character actor. You might have seen him. You're enough of a show business nerd. Remember the Comeback, the HBO show about the sitcom actress? Yeah, he played her husband, and he was a great waspy character named Pancho Wells, who was the rules chairman and kind of the sidekick to Patrick Dempsey, who actually played the Republican whip. So anyway, we had a lot of fun with that. And David was just incredible. And it was a pleasure to get to know him and hang out.
So this is great. So now the COVID is done. Are you out lunching at the Ivy and,
taking meetings over Shutters? Yeah, I have a purple Ferrari I drive up on. I've got a Wallace Berry wrestling picture coming up. No, I've got a couple of projects going on. I can't announce a couple of them, but I wrote a movie that seems to be coming to life, which is kind of fun. I wrote it for HBO, and then we got it back, and I'm partnered up with Leonardo DiCaprio's company, Appian Way, on that, and the great management and production company, Three Arts. And so we've got some great actors lined up. We have a tremendous director, and now we're slinking around with CAA getting some money to make it. And then I'm writing something else right now. So I'm the card-carrying member of the evil Hollywood world, right, so I do it on the side, and I enjoy it.
Charlie's going to kill me for turning his show into, Hollywood Hour.
Well, we could talk watches, too, and really scare everybody away, because I know you're a watch nerd. I am, too.
So here's my, I will close with a watch thing, but are you and are people out there as freaked out about theatrical exhibition as I have been? Because I have been just cranking the klaxon sirens since February of 2020, saying this COVID stuff is going to destroy theatrical. The exhibitors are going to be pushed in bankruptcy. That wound up not happening to AMC because AMC became a meme stock, helpfully. So AMC has been kept solvent by Reddit. Right. But that the other side
hopefully
is,
they've been turning that ridiculous bubble hype into cash to maybe save exhibition, at least in the short term. So that's a rare rainbow in the storm of madness of the crowds. But yeah.
Which is good. But the other part of this, the part you can't solve, is that as the studios consolidate, and we've functionally lost two studios, you're gonna go from having 8 or 9 studios pushing out 20 movies a year to 5 or 6 studios doing 10 movies a year. And of these, how many are going to be the kind of tentpole mainstream movies that bring people out to buy popcorn in large numbers over the weekends? Did you just have a product shortage?
Well, yeah, no, there's concern about it because television in the premium pay for networks or streaming is becoming a place. I mean, you look at The Mandalorian, the budget per episode on that is high into the double digit millions, which used to go pay for a Michael Clayton. But yes, there's concern. Now, in the creative community, nobody wants to give up the big screens, that experience for people who want them. In the business, remember, it's always show business. There's like, well, we have all these great new pipelines to do prestigious stuff. People watch on 50 or 60 inch plasma screens, live with it. The economics are better for mid-level stuff there. But I don't think exhibition is over completely. We are a social interacting people. So I think that tentpole world could come back. But there'd be a shakeout. There's no doubt we're going to have fewer screens. But I'm not quite sure I'm ready to bury exhibition. There is a lot of concern. You do want a differentiated experience because you can charge money for it on a big screen with a big tentpole movie. So I think that business model will still be around, but it is going to be reduced because the pandemic just squeezed the death out of the exhibitors were all leveraged to begin with, so they weren't built.
They had no assets
in the real estate business.
They have no actual physical assets, and the exhibition window has been shrunk now. And
that's the real issue, by the way.
That window is going to keep shrinking. That 45 days is not going to last.
There's debate about that. You may be right, but there's debate about it because the extra margin you get is the better big screen experience. If you want to see it on your home screen, you got to pay, but you got to wait. And when they merge them together, they get kind of the fast calories of some revenue. And the thing that lit that on fire is, it's a pandemic because the exhibition model was no longer there. But if it's back, I think the people who control the tentpole content will be like, well, wait a minute, let's go back and see if we can get an average sale of $30 on a big screen rather than squirting it out for $4 a month on streaming immediately. I think there might be a little counterforce once the exhibition platforms are back. But that's the fight. And it'll be the people who pay the bills who figure it out, not me. I'm in the content business.
Yeah, no, I get it. And believe me, I mean, but at root, all of show business is intellectual property business. And the value of intellectual property is generated by theatrical exhibition, not by streaming.
I'll tell you, the biggest thing you creatively bump into, and what people will tell you in the Hollywood creative community is, it's show business. TV is a business, though, because they need one every week. The feature world is a whole nother animal. And what you hear in feature world, you go pitch them a Michael Clayton now, they will be like, oh, go take that to streaming.
Take it to Netflix. Like
the movie I'm working on, we make it. My guess is we'll be in the Amazon versus Netflix versus Hulu versus Apple world rather than exhibition. Because what they will tell you in the exhibition world when you pitch it is, well, we don't want a lot of talking because the biggest single market's Asia, particularly China. So let's have giant tractors fight or something. That middle level movie has totally been supplanted into streaming.
All right. So what are you wearing on your wrist right now? 1 minute. You do 1 minute of watch talk.
Okay. Yeah. I am wearing a Rolex Sky Dweller in steel.
Ooh, the Sky Dweller.
Yes. Yeah. The first Rolex perpetual count. I don't know about first, but the modern one. And I tend to like steel watches, which of course are impossible to get. But after 20 years of collecting and a little bit of blackmail, I've got a couple of ways to get things now.
So I want to
authorized dealers, no gray market.
I want to brag to you about my latest watch. It is a Zinn. It's German. I know you like the German watches.
I do.
And it is the Zinn UX, which is Zinn's only quartz watch. and I am in general not a quartz guy. I'm a mechanical guy. But the UX was made specially for German Special Forces. And
they're great.
It is a thermocompensated quartz movement. But the reason it is quartz is because the entire case is filled with oil. And
it's
the
very
reason
cool.
it is filled with oil is to create counter pressure. So this thing is waterproof to 13 kilometers. Not 3,000 meters, which is itself, astonishing. Not 300 meters to 13 kilometers. It is made of tegumented submarine steel, U-boat Stahl.
Which only the Germans truly love.
And it is, a friend of mine was like, yeah, so what's so great about this watch? And I was like, my watch sank the Lusitania. That's what's so great about this.
Well, when the Trumpers throw you off his yacht and you descend into the trench, your skeletal remains will still have, as long as that battery lasts, the time will be being kept because the oil in the case, as you well know, or in the thing, is a counter pressure, so it's not crushed. You know who had I am a Sin fan, and a million years ago, I gave my then girlfriend, who was cool and funky enough to actually wear it, a Sin Bomb Squad watch.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, like 20 years ago. You can probably figure out who it was, and I don't know if she still has the watch, but I've been a Sin fan for a long time.
Wild. All right, Mike, thank you for coming on the show. Thanks for hanging out with me and indulging
me. It was great.
Charlie, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for all the things I've just done.
hey, Monday, do we have time for astrology or UFOs? We can totally hijack this thing here.
On Monday, Charlie Sykes will be back in the chair and he'll do this thing all over again.
And one fast plug before we say goodbye. This has been incredibly fun. JVL, good to talk to you. People, subscribe to The Bulwark. It is a indispensable chronicler of our time and a hope for the future. And if you want to hear more of my rambling, Hacks on Tap with me, David Axelrod, and Robert Gibbs every week on Apple Podcasts.